is Haywood against Hathaway.
Good morning. May it please the Court. This Court repeatedly has established that prison officials violate the Eighth Amendment when they ignore extremely cold conditions that persist over an extended period of time. For 60 days, in the middle of a frigid winter, Seon Haywood endured a combination of hardships in a dangerously cold segregation cell. A jury must decide if Warden Hathaway violated Mr. Haywood's Eighth Amendment rights when he knowingly turned a blind eye to all but one of the complaints in Mr. Haywood's January grievance and did nothing to protect Mr. Haywood from the substantial risk of serious harm from the ice storm and subsequent power outage. Evidence Mr. Haywood offered in the district court as a pro se litigant, including his testimony and an affidavit from an inmate who worked at the facility, was more than sufficient to demonstrate serious fact questions and survive summary judgment. With respect to Mr. Haywood's First Amendment retaliation claim, this court should reverse dismissal on two grounds. First, because the Illinois Department of Corrections restored Mr. Haywood's good conduct credits, so judgment on his First Amendment claim will affect neither the fact nor duration of his confinement. And second, because Mr. Haywood is willing to forever waive any claims he may have concerning duration and should be permitted to proceed on his claims related to the conditions of his confinement.
And on that point, how do we deal with the holding in Byrd against Sessler?
On Byrd, this court has never ruled that favorable termination applies in every situation, and in fact has held that in situations where habeas relief was never available, an inmate would be allowed to proceed with Section 1983 claims. But Byrd teaches us that Heck does bar a Section 1983 claim where the plaintiff chooses to delay either until he is out of custody or a statute of limitations has run. In Byrd, this court was focused on plaintiff's conduct, conduct that is not at issue here. Now, at 1:30 p.m. yesterday afternoon, I received an email from opposing counsel telling me that Mr. Haywood twice requested that the Illinois Department of Corrections restore his good conduct credits in 2011, and that the Illinois Department of Corrections denied those requests. I thank opposing counsel for providing me with notice, but the timing did not allow me opportunity to discuss the situation with my client. I respectfully request that the court allow me to interview our client with this new information and, with leave, provide the court with a supplemental brief. But this new disclosure aside, this still is not a case where Mr. Haywood knew of an impending deadline and felt that he could outwait it, the situation that faced this court in Byrd. In discussions with our client when we were preparing his initial brief, our client was utterly befuddled by what happened, and we requested documentation from the Illinois Department of Corrections and eventually received what we assumed was the file from the legal department at the Illinois Department of Corrections. That file is included in the separate appendix at pages 56 through 60. That file does not reflect any requests or denials of good conduct restoration in 2011 or at any time, nor does it reflect any reason why the good conduct credits were restored. So, to be clear, Byrd turned on the conduct of an inmate who knew when he was going to be released from custody. Mr. Haywood did not know if or when the Illinois Department of Corrections would restore his good conduct credits. Moreover, Mr. Haywood's...
Counsel, I must say I'm puzzled by this whole line of argument. How can what happened after the district court ruled show that the district court made an error? We reverse district judges who make errors. That's the job of an appellate court. But there wasn't any error here. What happened later doesn't show an error. What the holding of Heck is that a claim doesn't accrue until the decision has been set aside, Heck and Edwards. And we supplemented that by saying that claim can accrue when there are no more rulings, subject to the Byrd proviso. But the district court didn't make an error because he dismissed this suit without prejudice, dismissed this claim without prejudice. So one would think that if circumstances change after the district court rules, the thing to do is take advantage of the fact that the dismissal is without prejudice and file a new lawsuit after the claim has, in your view, finally accrued. Why are you trying to get us to reverse for an error not made rather than just filing a new lawsuit as the dismissal without prejudice invited?
Your Honor, I agree that it wasn't an error because this is something that changed afterwards. We're simply arguing that Heck doesn't apply.
That would be an argument to make in a new lawsuit. The retaliation claim is dismissed without prejudice. After a dismissal without prejudice, circumstances change, so you file a new lawsuit. That's the normal course of events. Asking the Court of Appeals to reverse a district judge who did not make an error is not the normal course of events.
And in response, the state is contending that the dismissal should be affirmed because Mr. Haywood's failed to state a claim, and so obviously...
If we affirm a dismissal without prejudice, and that's what the district judge said it was, you can still file another lawsuit. So I don't know why the state is asking us to affirm a dismissal without prejudice. Maybe what the state should have done was file a cross appeal and say the dismissal should be made with prejudice, but the state did not file a cross appeal. There is nothing an affirmance would do to prevent you from filing another lawsuit.
I agree, Your Honor. The one thing that this court could do, however, is clarify that Heck does not apply in a situation like Mr. Haywood.
I believe the phrase for that is obiter dictum, or maybe it's advisory opinion, right? If a new lawsuit should be filed, if your client files another lawsuit, then that issue will become relevant. But normally, we don't try to resolve lawsuits that haven't yet been filed.
I understand.
And for good reason.
The fact remains, though, Your Honor, that there is that there would be a benefit from clarity from this court that inmates who cannot seek habeas, like Mr. Haywood, not because he outran a statute of limitations or because he waited until he was no longer in custody, can proceed with a Section 1983 claim under the First Amendment.
I just don't see how we could reach that in any way, given that the dismissal was without prejudice to filing a new lawsuit on the retaliation claim. All we could do, in the absence of a cross appeal by the state, is affirm that decision. Let's come back to the main event here, the Eighth Amendment claim against the warden. And I'll tell you what my worry is. It's the second half of that phrase, against the warden. The operating assumption here, and I know you weren't responsible for suing the warden and nobody but the warden.
That's right.
That's your client's choice. But the normal rule under Ashcroft against Iqbal is that wardens and attorneys general are not liable for the misconduct of their subordinates. The operating assumption of this lawsuit seems to be that if you send the top of an organization a letter saying that your subordinates are misbehaving, then the top of the organization becomes personally liable. So on that rationale, if Haywood had sent his letter to the governor of Illinois, the governor of Illinois would be personally liable. If he had sent it to President Obama, President Obama would be personally liable. And that seems to me to run rather headlong into our en banc decision in Vance against Rumsfeld, which said that by alerting the head of an organization to misconduct by subordinates, you can't make the head of the organization liable. Isn't that a problem here?
No, Your Honor, it's not a problem, because here it isn't as if Warden Hathaway had no role in the decisions that were made and had no part. I mean, there is sufficient.
But the warden's part, at least so far as this record goes, seems to have been to send a maintenance man who reported the temperature is 75.
That's right.
And I take it that that's conceded, that, in fact, he did send a maintenance man. The maintenance man reported, correctly or not, right? There's no constitutional violation in that. So the role the warden chose for himself was to send the maintenance man. No violation of the Constitution there. The argument that you're making is that the warden had to do something else. The warden had to go himself. The warden had to be, had to do the maintenance himself. It wasn't enough to send a subordinate and act through a bureaucratic hierarchy. And that's the kind of argument that Vance against Rumsfeld rejects.
I disagree, Your Honor, because the grievance, the January grievance from Mr. Haywood, alerted Warden Hathaway to multiple different hardships. And the district court even recognized.
I'm distinguishing Vance against Rumsfeld by saying something like that. The panel decision in Vance against Rumsfeld said that Secretary Rumsfeld could be liable because people had sent him reports saying that his subordinates were engaged in misconduct. And we said that is not an adequate basis of liability under Ashcroft against Iqbal.
Warden Hathaway had a duty, an acknowledged duty, to protect inmates from serious risk to health and safety.
That was the panel's holding in Vance against Rumsfeld, and the en banc court rejected it. It's not clear to me that you're familiar with Vance against Rumsfeld.
I am not, Your Honor. I apologize.
Well, you should have said that at the outset. If everything you're saying was considered by the en banc court in Vance against Rumsfeld and rejected. Now, what you should be saying is that the state has never relied on Vance against Rumsfeld, and it seems perfectly content with a rule under which if wardens don't respond adequately to grievances, the warden becomes personally liable. The state may have forfeited its reliance on Ashcroft against Iqbal and Vance against Rumsfeld, neither of which is cited in the state's brief, but I find it awfully hard to distinguish them if they have adequately been preserved.
I see that I'm entering my rebuttal time, so if there are no further questions at this time, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary.
Well, are you relying on Ashcroft against Iqbal and Vance against Rumsfeld?
We, in fact, relied on different cases, Your Honor, and remember
well,
that
I
the
eighth. That because your brief doesn't cite either one of them.
That's correct, Your Honor, because this
it
also is about summary.
Odd. You've got two cases that make your client a dead bang lay down winner, and you don't cite them.
Excuse me, Your Honor, but Iqbal's a 12b-6 case, and this was about summary judgment, so we felt that we should rely on the summary judgment cases that say that. That wardens are allowed to rely on their subordinates and don't when you have a difference of opinion between an inmate and a staff member. If the information you get from an inmate and a staff member differ, you are not, the Constitution doesn't oblige you to believe the inmate over the staff member. And also, we did cite cases that say that not just wardens, but supervisors do not have responsibility for, do not have liability for the misdeeds of their staff. Although there were no misdeeds here that the warden knew about. Remember, if we want to talk about the Eighth Amendment claim first, the plaintiff's first grievance said, "It's really cold in here for four reasons." Within 24 hours, Warden Hathaway sent a staff member down there and to check the temperature. Plaintiff is correct about that in the reply brief, to check the temperature in segregation. And the temperature was 75 degrees, just as if plaintiff had said, there's a flood down here because all of the spigots are open, and the staff member had come back and said, there's no flood, there would have been no reason to check the spigots. Because it was 75 degrees, there was no reason to check the causes, the alleged causes of the cold that didn't exist. Now, again, this is Eighth Amendment is about criminally reckless, the equivalent of criminally reckless responses to complaints, to serious risks of harm. So the response here was to send a staff member down to check the temperature. He checked the temperature. The temperature was 75 degrees, so there was no reason to check the causes.
Is there anything in the record that shows that he did check the temperature and that the temperature was 75 degrees, or only that he said he checked the temperature and he said the temperature was 75 degrees?
To my knowledge, plaintiff is not disputing that. In fact, I believe in their brief they say that the
plaintiff's brief is disputing the truth of those statements. And people in bureaucratic hierarchies have been known to gold brick and then lie by saying they did the work, which they didn't do.
Certainly that's true, but there's no evidence to show that Warden Hathaway knew that or had any reason to know that.
As long as it is undisputed, and Ms. Perry did not disagree with the proposition that somebody actually told the warden it was 75.
Correct.
It's very hard to see the basis for the suit against the warden. Did the prison system investigate this to see whether people at the prison had engaged in misbehavior by not adequately securing the heating system and the segregation unit?
There is no evidence either way in the record about that.
Is there any evidence that the warden ever did anything about the complaint that the guards were
turning on the blowers?
Dealing with the blowers inflict discomfort or whatever you want to call it on the prisoners.
Right. Again, Your Honor, because that was one of the causes of the cold, and because the cold allegation, the cold complaint was found to be, or at least was Warden Hathaway was told that the cold complaint, there was no basis for the cold complaint because it was 75 degrees. There was no reason for him to say, well, wait a second. You know, let's look at the causes of the non-cold.
Well, do we even know if the blowers were on when mechanic went down to check the heating system?
We do not. There's no evidence in the record on that either.
And then the warden, in response to an interrogatory, admitted he visited segregation while Haywood was housed there. And what appellants are arguing is that you can make some reasonable inferences that he knew of the conditions from that one visit.
Your Honor, again, there's no evidence. You would think that in the three sets of interrogatories, the plaintiff would have said, he did ask, did you visit segregation? Warden Hathaway said, I did. And that the plaintiff could have asked, when you were in segregation, did you see that the blowers were on? Did you see that there were windows open? Did you see any of this? And the plaintiff didn't ask any of those questions. So there's really no evidence to support any knowledge by the plaintiff other than that these were causes of a cold within the segregation unit that as far as the warden knew, didn't exist. And again, with regard to the ice storm, you know, the evidence shows that Warden Hathaway knew there was an ice storm. He made sure the generators were going to be working. He knew that the generators were working, and he had periodic temperature checks. None of this is disputed. And the Constitution doesn't require more. Particularly, remember, there was not a single complaint from plaintiff or anybody else, apparently, from the day that plaintiff walked into segregation to the day he walked out that Warden Hathaway saw, or that plaintiff sent to Warden Hathaway, that there was still cold. There was no evidence in the record. Now, I would suggest that had Warden Hathaway received not just the first grievance here, but received a couple of grievances after he was told that it was cold and the guys came back and said, no, everything's fine. If he had received more, then there might have been a duty to do more. There would have been perhaps a doubt created. But here there was no doubt created. Warden Hathaway was told it was 75 degrees. Therefore, there was no reason to look further into the causes of the cold the plaintiff complained of because the cold did not exist. And also, there's no evidence that Warden Hathaway saw plaintiff's second grievance until the day he left. There's no evidence that Warden Hathaway was in the prison between the day that plaintiff sent in the second grievance and Warden Hathaway saw it. So there's really no evidence to show that Warden Hathaway was the equivalent of criminally reckless in given what he knew and what he did in response to what he knew. If there are no questions about the Eighth Amendment, I'd like to turn to the First Amendment claim. And the district court was completely correct about this in terms in getting rid of this claim, because at the time plaintiff had not exhausted, plaintiff was seeking invalidation of the disciplinary decision, and this is precisely what Heck, Edwards, and Byrd bar. You cannot seek, and you cannot bring a 1983 claim that that necessarily would invalidate the disciplinary decision, and that's exactly what plaintiff did. He says the disciplinary decision was not correct. It was in retaliation. It was false. I, in fact, did not give false information. So although plaintiff says, well, really, I'm not seeking to invalidate the decision because I'm not seeking to get back my good conduct credits, that's not the point of the invalidation, the favorable termination rule. The favorable termination rule concerns whether the decision, the disciplinary decision that he gave false information, was correct or was it incorrect because it was for retaliation. So even if there could be a carve-out from Heck for a plaintiff in this case, and there cannot be. Heck does not permit a carve-out. Heck itself, although Justice Souter's concurrences in subsequent cases would like to have done that, he was not in the majority. There is no carve-out, and this is what Byrd acknowledges. There is no carve-out from Heck for people who can get collateral relief and do not. Here, plaintiff had multiple opportunities for relief to invalidate the decision. He could have appealed it. The decision itself says, if you disagree with this, go through the grievance process. He did not. He did not seek any sort of state court relief. He did not seek habeas relief. And because he didn't do any of those things, his claim did not accrue. It was not yet cognizable, his First Amendment claim. And so the district court, and it sought to invalidate the disciplinary decision. And for those two reasons, the district court properly dismissed, on Heck grounds, the First Amendment retaliation claim. And unless there are questions about this, I would like to turn to, just for a moment, to the suspension motion issue. In fact, the district court granted plaintiff's first suspension motion and extended the due date for his reply to the defendant's summary judgment motion. And in his second motion, the district court actually granted in part, although plaintiff didn't know it, because it again extended the deadline for the response to the summary judgment motion. But also, the district court found that defendant Warden Hathaway had complied with its order. And plaintiff makes the curious argument that he knows better than the district court whether the discovery that the district court saw complied with the district court's own order. And I would suggest that the district court does not abuse its discretion when it makes a decision that discovery responses comply with the court's own discovery orders. Unless there are any other questions, we ask that the court affirm both the dismissal of the First Amendment retaliation claim as to all the defendants without prejudice, and that the court affirm the summary judgment order against plaintiff. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Anything further, Ms. Perry?
Judge Easterbrook, you asked what this court could do with the First Amendment claim, given that the conditions, specifically the restoration of good conduct credits, occurred after judgment. And I would ask that this court consider Mr. Haywood's Peralta argument and consider applying the Second Circuit's decision in Peralta, where it permitted an individual who received a mixed sentence, meaning a sentence that impacted both duration and conditions of confinement, to waive claims relating to the duration of confinement so as to proceed with conditions of confinement. I think this court could make that decision and allow Mr. Haywood to proceed through dismissal without having to return and...
I gather that that approach has not been well received by other circuits. Have you done a census of what's happened in the courts of appeals on that question?
We have, and haven't found a courts of appeals case rejecting Peralta. Hathaway has offered only two reasons why the court shouldn't adopt Peralta. As we briefed, we think neither is persuasive, but the procedural complexities that we've discussed a bit today that frequently come with HEC's favorable termination requirement is another reason in favor of adopting Peralta, because it would streamline the litigation process. Rather than requiring Mr. Haywood to go back and file another lawsuit and go through the process again, it would allow him to simply proceed with the claim that he intended to assert in the first place. Returning to the Eighth Amendment claim, the only thing that it's fair to assume from the temperature check in Mr. Haywood's cell is that on an unseasonably warm day that winter, in one portion of his cell, the temperature was 75 degrees. But Warden Hathaway knew, or at least had knowledge of, Mr. Haywood's other grievances, including the broken window that was letting cold air through, and the temperature check reveals nothing about what it was like in his cell right in front of the broken window, and the fact that the guards were using blowers like air conditioners. That's how he described it.
Are these blowers part of the heating system, or are they some separate machine or implement?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. Finally, I'd just like to say that Mr. Haywood's failure to file a mandamus action to seek invalidation of his action, of the underlying disciplinary proceeding, is excusable and should be excused by this court. He contested the dismissal of his claim for 7 months. He filed a motion, and remember that he was contesting it pro se. He filed a motion to reconsider, attempting to clarify for the court that he was not attempting to challenge the duration of his confinement, only the conditions. His motion to reconsider was outstanding until December of 2010, and the Illinois Department of Corrections restored his time in July of 2012, but there's no statute of limitations on mandamus claims in Illinois, so there was no reason he would be unnoticed that he needed to proceed with more haste. I see my time is up, so unless there are other questions, I'm happy to close.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. And Ms. Perry, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.